Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves, presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp for your chance to win a $200 tattered cover gift certificate. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute. It's time to begin.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Tattered Cover. We're really pleased that you came out on this night, and we're really excited tonight to welcome Jamie Ford with his already critically acclaimed debut novel, Hotel on the Corner of Bitter and Sweet. Jamie is a self-described dude. Was trained as an illustrator, has won what he calls an embarrassing number of awards for his works and art direction, over 400. That could be embarrassing. When he began writing short stories, the awards kept coming, and it certainly looks like the pattern will go on with the evocative and beautifully written novel. So let's welcome him to the Tattered Cover, and I think you want to hear him.
Thank you. Wow, what a crowd. First of all, thanks for the sacrifice. I know American Idol's on tonight, and that's a sacrifice. If it wasn't for TiVo, there'd be like two people here, and I'm related to them. So thank you for that sacrifice. It's noted. This is really cool. I've been on the tour now. This is maybe my 10th stop. I'm not sure. Maybe 9th. I've been on a tour enough to where I'm enjoying it, but not so long that I have stalkers and things like that. So it's going great. The cool thing about being on tour is, and especially since this is my maiden voyage, this is my debut novel, is I'm still getting emails from my editor and my publicist along the way, because the book is just, it's just kind of hitting the road now. My first stop, I think I got an email that said, okay, we're number four in Seattle or something like that. And then I'd get one that would say, we're number eight in Chicago or whatever it is. I get this sort of transom of good news. And I'm always happy to be able to come to a group and sort of dish the latest, before anyone else knows. So I'm happy to report that, it's the weirdest thing. That Hotel is a national bestseller now. Thank you. And being a typical neurotic writer, I always have to qualify that. So I'm like asking my editor, okay, does that mean we're number one in Poughkeepsie and we're number one in Yakima, therefore we're a net? She's assured me that we're legit, so that's cool. Wow. What I do want to talk about a little bit is, and part of about being on tour is I do a lot of interviews naturally. It's my first book. And I love the interviews. They're great. And I know we'll do some Q&A and we'll talk about a lot of things. But the interviews, and it's probably because I have such a great publicist and she provides them with such great questions, but the questions are sort of similar. There are questions naturally about the Japanese internment, which is portrayed in the book. And there are questions about the Seattle jazz scene, and there are questions about perhaps race relations between Chinese and Japanese, and those type of things. And I'm always happy to answer those questions. But it's an interesting contrast to the emails that I get from readers now, that people have actually read the book, and my website's in there. They track me down, so I get the emails, and the emails are so different, and the emails are really of the nature of, you made me cry. That's kind of the emails I get. I'm still crying and I'm on Prozac now. Thank you. But really I had a review in, I think it was the Daily Iowan, and I didn't even read the review, but I just looked at the headline and it stopped me and made me laugh out loud. And it just said, this book will rupture your tear ducts. And I couldn't go any further. That was just That was my reaction. I was just like, ow, sorry about that. You know, this picture blood stigmatically coming out of someone's eyes in a class action lawsuit. So, but it was interesting that with readers pick up on something else. Reviewers, for the most part, have read the book, or at least read the notes sufficiently to make me believe they've read the book. And they ask about these other things. And the emails, the emotional reaction isn't, though it's compelling and it's tragic, the emotional reaction isn't all about the internment or about the jazz scene or about history or race relations or the Panama Hotel. The emotional reaction is usually to the love story. I shouldn't say usually, it's always to the love story. Because at its heart, Hotel really is just a classic, simple love story. And love stories are funny things. You know, you go to a sappy movie, and when the lights come on as people are leaving, there are people that are crying, and then there are people that are just like, what the heck was that? You know, where was the asteroid and the car chases and the gun battles and things like that? And early on, not just as a writer, but as a person, you know, I realized I'm a sucker for love stories. I'm a big sucker for love stories. And it started when I was a little kid. And, you know, as I've put this book together, I kind of had to reflect and do a little self-examination. And I thought about, in my own life, when I really, you know, fell for love stories. And it happened when I was probably third grade. I was probably 9 years old. I mean, I was an odd duck. And at the time, I was living in a little theater town. It's not so little anymore, but of Ashland, Oregon. And people are nodding like, yeah, it's a nice place. And it's an interesting place to grow up. But Ashland, Oregon in the 70s, we had one channel. This is sort of pre-cable. And so when you have one channel, you know, it's not a choice of what to watch. It's just, do you watch or do you, you know, do something else? And as a result, as a kid, I watched some really weird stuff. You know, it was very, you know, you just watch what's on. And one movie that stuck with me, and I mean, to this day, it stuck with me, was this movie called James at 15. I don't know if anyone's... All right, yes, my people are here. We're going to bring it back. It's going to be remade. My given name is James, and so I was kind of interested. And the movie was set in Oregon. I was living in Oregon at the time, so I had a little buy-in even as a little kid. And James at 15 was this, you know, just to give you the CliffsNotes version, it's this very simple love story. And it's about this kid who's pining away for this unattainable girl. And in the end, he gets her in a very 70s way. You know, it's not the OC. Very simple love story. But it didn't end there. It ended with James and his family moving to Boston. And so he's in the back seat of their car waving out the window at his sweetheart who's on the sidewalk waving goodbye. They drive away, and the credits start rolling, and there's a sad piano music, and that was the end. And, you know, as a little kid, I'm looking at this, and I'm thinking, love sucks. This is, you know, every relationship I'd seen up to that point had been through the Disney filter, you know, about the emotional depth of the Nutty Professor was kind of where I was at. Nothing wrong with that. But as a kid, I'm watching this and I'm crying. I have tears coming down my cheeks. And, you know, my poor dad is sitting there next to me. And, you know, I'm a dad. I see some guys in the room. You're probably dads. You got the list. You got the dad list. And you know what the dad list is. And my dad's looking at me and he's like, football scholarship, cross that one off the list. And I'm crying at the sappy, you know, made for the weekly movie, you know, basketball scholarship, cross that off. And he encouraged me to go into the arts. So, you know, my background is in art. So way to go, dad. This one's for you. I scored a writer's touchdown, Dad. So, but it's funny. And at the time, you know, all my friends had the same one channel. So at school, you know, everyone's calling me, hey, James at 15, James at 15. And everyone thought the movie sucked. And I was the only person that liked it. And I knew I was a little different back then. And my folks did too, and that's good. James at 16, and you know, and they turned it into a series called James at 16, which lasted like two episodes. Because if you were a drama in the 70s, you were pretty much killed by Hee Haw and the Dukes of Hazzard. You know, 70s was not like this apex of drama in our culture. The best drama was probably All in the Family and MASH, and those were comedies. So, but yeah, I did. And I, you know, and I was bummed when the show went off because I was. That was my show, and it was, and I could talk about that, and maybe I will. But flash forward to adulthood, because as an adult, you sort of reconcile those moments. You sort of put them in a box and look at them through an adult lens, and you sort of classify them as this moment in time. And it wasn't really until I had met my wife and we went to one of these, we were engaged at the time. We went to one of these weekends for, you know, for couples. They take like 20 couples and they throw you in a room and you spend the weekend there and you work on, you talk about things and, you know, which is that the human dynamic of that alone is pretty striking because, you know, you're all looking at each other like you're a goner and you might make it. And yeah, I mean, it's fun. Even if you're married, you should just go just if you're bored, because that would be probably cheap entertainment on like a Saturday. But I went to one of these and we were a bit older than all the other couples. We were like the chaperones on prom night. You know, it was a little weird. But while we were there, well, the first thing they had us do was stand up and introduce ourselves and tell the story of how we met. And, you know, which is peculiar. And by the time it got around to us, we were the only couple whose first meeting didn't involve, like, you know, spring break or a frat party or Jello shooters or something like that. You know, it was very, very different. And then I had to stand up in this sort of post-collegial, you know, coupling experiment and tell everyone that I met my wife at that hotbed of swinging singles activity known as the public library. Yeah, no, it wasn't even wet t-shirt night or anything like that. It was just the library. And that's when I knew I wasn't James at 15. I was James at 40. You know, I was a precocious kid and I'm a precocious adult, I think. So, and so when I set out as a writer, you know, I like love stories. And so I set out to try my hand at, you know, sort of a throwback, really. And before I did that, I started looking at classic love stories in literature and in film and examining them. And if you think about it, you probably, you know, just around the room, if you think about a love story, you're probably going to think of one that's probably older than you are. And that's why it's a classic. And I mean, maybe there's some great, you know, modern love stories. But the classics, they resonate for a reason. And, you know, I wanted to examine that. I mean, really, I mean, especially in film, because we're a society that we dispose of great films quite readily. And it was interesting to think about Casablanca, you know, classic love story. And it's so sublime and it's so understated that by today's standards, you know, it's so subtle, but it's a classic. And, you know, what would the modern version of that look like? Would that be any more of a classic if we had this flashback of Rick and Ilsa in some Paris hotel and it's just a sweaty love scene, you know? No, it's a classic because it's understated. And as a writer, I was attracted to that. Also, you know, other classics, Gone with the Wind, you know, classic novel, not so understated because Scarlett's, you know, pretty out there. But the love story, you know, I mean, she's kind of lost and kind of bounces around a little bit, but her relationship with Red is still, you know, so much is left on the table, so to speak. you know, the classic scene, you know, the end with, you know, Rhett and Scarlett, you know, frankly, my dear, I don't have a condom. You know, oh, they didn't say that. Sorry. Yeah. Juvenile, I know. Sorry. I apologize. But as a writer, you have to find a balance, find that sense of decorum. And today as a writer, you know, you can write anything and you'll find an audience, really. But I was really trying to write something that meant something to me on an emotional level. And that was something that was a bit of a throwback, and that was something that was understated. And so Hotel really is a simple love story. It's the story of a young Chinese boy named Henry Lee, who was sent to an all-white private school by his parents, ostensibly to become more American. And this is after the bombings of Pearl Harbor. This is set in Seattle. And there he meets Keiko, who is a young Japanese girl sent by her parents for similar reasons. And together they form this very innocent affection. It's a very, really a simple love story. And if you follow the Japanese internment, not follow, but if you follow history and understand the internment, you're aware that the entire Japanese community was taken away and put in internment camps for, you know, quote unquote, their protection, even though the machine guns pointed into the camps and not out of the camps. And so you know that much about the story. So you know at some point Henry and Keiko are going to lose each other. And it's also the story of Henry Lee as a grown man. And he's a widow. He's a widower now. He's in his 50s. And he's looking back on that time. And he's passing by iconic landmark in what was then Seattle's Japantown, called the Panama Hotel. And in the 80s, the owner of the hotel made an amazing discovery. And that was the belongings of 37 Japanese families in the basement that had been there for four decades, virtually untouched. And so that's a nonfiction element that is incorporated into the book. And in the book, the character Henry comes upon a bit of a impromptu news conference as these belongings are coming up out of the basement. And he sees a koi parasol that's opened for the cameras, and he recognizes it as belonging to Keiko. And at that moment, he's sort of forced to look back on that time and examine the things he did or didn't do, the things he said, the things he left unspoken. And I would tell you more, but then you wouldn't buy the book, so I'll stop there. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to read you just a little snippet. And when it comes to readings, I lean towards the brief side. And part of that is because there's a lot of nonfiction in the book, and I think that's, you know, our time is better spent as a dialogue and less of a monologue. So Q&A is great. But also, I'm just paranoid about readings because we were all read to as children at bedtime. And I just have this fear. I'm going to look up and everyone's going to be nodded off and curled up with your blankets. And I'll just turn out the lights and close the door and you'll wake up tomorrow. So what's happened, this is end of the book, about 70 pages. And what's happened at this point in the book is Henry and Keiko have met. They spent time together in school. They've spent time together outside of school. And it's very clear that there's this fondness, affection, almost love between them at this time. But what's been going on in the city around them in Seattle is there have been FBI raids after the bombings of Pearl Harbor, but before the internment, the FBI would go into Nihonmachi and arrest Japanese Americans who spoke English, perhaps, making them a suspect for spying. They would confiscate radios, confiscate camera equipment. And there was a general hysteria at the time. I mean, it was so odd to look back on now, but the farmers in the area were accused of planting their crops in the direction of the Puget Sound Naval Shipyard, as if, you know, a bomber was going to follow a strawberry patch and drop its payload and, you know, that kind of thing. But that was the general, you know, the country had been struck, and you know, fear was in the streets. And so what's happened at this moment in the book is Henry comes to school. He knows these raids have taken place the night before. Goes to class and Keiko's absent. And so fearing for her safety and the safety of her family, he cuts class, goes outside, and he sees smoke billowing over the rooftops in the direction of Japantown. And that's where we jump into the story. Running toward the smoke, Henry avoided Chinatown altogether. Not because he was afraid of being seen by his parents during school hours, though that was part of it, but because of the truant officers. It was almost impossible to skip school where Henry was from. Truant officers patrolled the streets and parks, even small noodle factories and canneries, looking for migrant children whose parents often sent them to work full-time rather than to school. The families probably needed the extra money, but locals like Henry's father believed that educated children meant less crime. Maybe they were right. The International District was normally quite peaceful, aside from occasional gang violence by rival Tongs or by enlisted men who wandered in, then staggered out drunk and ripe for trouble. Plus, any police officer seeing an Asian kid in the on the street during school hours would usually pick him up as well. He'd be sent home where the poor kid's punishment by his parents would probably make him regret not being thrown in jail. So Henry cautiously edged his way along Yesler Way on the Nihonmachi side, all the way to Kobe Park, which was now deserted. Walking through the corridors of Japantown, he saw a few people out, like a Sunday morning in downtown Seattle when all the shops and businesses were closed, and those that were open had few patrons. "What am I doing here?" he asked himself, looking up from the barren streets to the cold sky, plumes of black smoke snaking skyward from places unseen. "I'll never find her." Still, he kept busy wandering from building to building, avoiding the strange looks on the faces of the few men and women he saw about. In the heart of Japantown, Henry found the Ochi Photography Studio once again. He couldn't miss the young proprietor who stood outside on a milk crate looking through a large camera mounted on a wooden tripod. He was shooting in an alley that ran in the same direction as Maynard when Henry saw the source of the fires. They weren't Japanese homes or businesses as he'd feared. There were large burning barrels and garbage cans set ablaze in the alley, fire and smoke pluming up and over the apartment buildings on either side. "Why are you taking pictures of garbage fires?" Henry asked, not sure if the photographer even recognized him. The man looked through Henry, then his eyes blinked as he seemed to remember him. It must have been the button he wore. The photographer turned back to his camera, his hands shaking. "They're not burning garbage." Henry stood at the T where the alley met the street, next to the photographer on his milk crate and his camera and his flashbulbs. Looking down the alley, he could see people coming and going from the apartment buildings, throwing things into the burning barrels. A woman yelled out of a third-story window to a man below and threw down a plum-colored kimono that looped and swirled, settling like falling snow on the dirty, slug-trailed pavement of the alley. The man below scooped it up, regarded it for a moment, hesitated, and then threw it on the fire. The silky fabric lit, and burning pieces floated out of the heat like butterflies whose wings caught flame, fluttering on the draft, flickering out, and raining down as black, ashy dust. An old woman brushed by Henry with an armload of papers, throwing them into the fire, where they made a whooshing sound. Henry felt the rush of heat on his cheeks and stepped back. Even from a distance, he could see there were scrolls, artwork written and drawn by hand, large Japanese characters disappearing into the heart of the fire. "Why are they doing this?" Henry asked, not fully understanding what he was seeing. "They arrested more people last night. Japanese, all over the city. All over Puget Sound. All over the state, maybe," the photographer told him. "People are getting rid of anything that might connect them with the war with Japan. Letters, clothing, it all must go, too dangerous to keep. Even old photos. People are burning photos of their parents and of their families." Henry watched an old man wearily place a neatly folded Japanese flag into the nearest burning barrel, saluting it as it burned. The photographer snapped the shutter on his camera, capturing the scene. "I burned all my old photos last night." He turned to Henry, the tripod shaking as he held it. With his other hand, he wiped his mouth with a handkerchief. "I burned my own wedding photos." Henry's eyes stung as they filled with smoke and soot. And he heard a woman yelling something in Japanese somewhere in the distance, and it sounded more like crying. "We had a traditional wedding right here in Nihonmachi. Then we took our photos at Washington Park Arboretum in front of the magnolias and the rock roses. We wore kimonos and Shinto dressing that had been in my family for three generations. The photographer looked haunted by the scene in front of him, haunted by the destruction of touchable, tangible remainders of life. I burned it all. Henry had seen all he could take. Turning, he ran home, still tasting the smoke. Thank you. That's a little bit of the bitter. I assure you there is some sweet in there as well. But it's a scene that really captures the lengths that people went to prove they were American or define their citizenship. And it's true. It's non-fictional. It's a fictionalized account of things that people actually did. Thank you very much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we've been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp. for your chance to win a $200 Tattered Cover gift certificate and learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.